Hi, I'm Chiwetel Ejiofor, and these are the movies that changed my life.
Hey everyone, I'm Ian DeBorja, and welcome to IMDb's Movies That Changed My Life, a podcast where your favorite stars break down the films that made them who they are today. This week's guest is actor and director Chiwetel Ejiofor. You may know Chiwetel from the modern classic 12 Years a Slave, or as Carl Mordo in the Doctor Strange franchise. But you will be able to catch him as Copley in Netflix's The Old Guard, which hits the streaming service on July 10th. Chiwetel and I talk about how growing up in London, England influenced his life to become an actor, his deep love for one of the greatest film directors of all time, Ingmar Bergman, and the three movies that changed his life. Once again, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to give us a star rating and leave a review, because every single one counts. Thanks to Dale_A and Jobadiah25 for the most recent 5-star reviews. It is much appreciated. Thanks again for listening. Now here's Movies That Changed My Life with Chiwetel Ejiofor. I had a chance to watch the new Netflix film that you star in alongside the fantastic Charlize Theron, Kiki Layne, among many, many others, called The Old Guard. It comes out July 10th. It is based off a short-form graphic novel, like a short miniseries that came out in 2017 by Greg Rucka. And Leandro Fernandez, and they also wrote the screenplay, which is fantastic, and is directed by the great Gina Prince Bythewood. But for those who are unfamiliar, can you tell us what The Old Guard is all about?
Yeah, The Old Guard is about a group of mercenaries who are immortal, and they, you know, they don't really celebrate exactly their immortality. In fact, they wear it in a sort of as a heavy cloak, you know, as a duty, really. And I play Copley, who's an ex-CIA agent who engages the old guard in a job which sort of seems initially kind of straightforward and for very good reasons. But then obviously in the way of things turns much more complex and everybody has sort of different motivations, let's say. And so their road is much more complicated once they engage with me and a few others. So that's kind of them. It's fun. And it's, like you say, Gina Prince-Bythewood directed it, and it's, you know, it's exciting, but it also has a kind of a healthy dollop of sort of existential angst, I think, which was exciting to me.
Yeah, one of my notes was powerful messages about immortality and mortality and the lengths people will go to protect it, and then the lengths, you know, people go to harness it. Like the second act there's quite a bit. Your character in particular, there's some great pieces of dialogue in there that sort of explains your relationship with immortality and mortality that I think fans will connect to. Especially right now, kind of. So something that stood out to me is that you have some fantastic scenes with Harry Melling. Mm. Some people who might not be as familiar. Harry Melling played Dudley Dursley in the Harry Potter film series. Harry Melling plays Stephen Merrick, and he is phenomenal in this. You two have such fun scenes together. What was it like working with him? Every time you two were on screen together, I really enjoyed it, both your performances.
Yeah, no, he was great. It was great to work with him because he, you know, he really embraced this character in a really strong way. And he made, I thought, just fantastic choices in terms of how he was going to play him. And, you know, and I think when you're making those kind of choices, there's always a risk that they don't land, you know, or, you know, you sort of worry about it. And that's why a lot of actors sort of shy away from kind of going there. But, you know, it's so important for actors to feel free to explore characters however they want to, you know. And in this case, it was perfect and it just landed so well. But, you know, I'm always impressed by actors who kind of just sort of step up to those roles, which, you know, require something a little bit, I think a little bit big and a little bit different and really go for it. You know, there's a long tradition of that, you know. I mean, you know, Hannibal Lecter's sort of teeth sucking hiss, you know, was improvised apparently. So, you know, if Anthony Hopkins hadn't just gone for it, you know, you wouldn't have that moment. You know, you have to kind of feel free to engage, I think.
Just, you know, I saw him, I was like, oh, that's cool. You know, that's Dudley from Harry Potter. And then he totally, like, you know, I completely, like, lost that thought once you started talking and like the story started going. He was really great, you two together. So Gina Prince-Bythewood, she also directed Love and Basketball, which is a classic film. You haven't worked with her up until this point, correct?
That's true. No, I haven't.
So were you a fan of Love and Basketball before? And what was it like when you finally got to, meet her and work on set together?
Yeah, I was a fan of hers. And I loved her film Beyond the Lights as well. Mm-hmm. And I really engaged with that. And so I was excited. And I was excited for her to take on something of this size and something that's in the kind of the action genre. And with these two female leads. That I thought was just a great way of looking at the action genre, basically, of just coming at it from a different angle, and with somebody like Gina helming that, I just thought this is going to be really fascinating, really interesting, and with that being Charlize and Kiki, I thought, well, there we go again. It's compounding the fascination and the interest and how this point of view and this kind of way of telling stories. That are, sadly still quite rare. And, so I was really excited by the prospect of all of that. So I was thrilled. And then, so I got it when I met her and we had a, our first conversation, it was just very clear that, that she just was somebody who was just very interested in all of those kind of interpersonal dynamics, obviously all of the action stuff and making that really work and making that really sing. But with somebody like Charlize as well, one of her great gifts, I think, is that she is able to bring narrative to physicality, which is not very easy to do. And only very few people actually can achieve that. And that really means, when you break it down, that you have to know fights inside out. You have to really understand fights and your physicality and be really in control of it to be able to put in character and narrative into a fight sequence. I've tried, it's not easy, so you end up having, normally you end up, you do the scene and then everything stops in the film or whatever. And then you have a fight sequence, but what Charlize is able to do is to carry through the conversation, if you like, in inverted commas, into the fight sequence, which I just think is really impressive.
Yeah. The action sequences are awesome. They're super fun. It gets some pretty brutal deaths along the way. Charlize is such a phenomenal action star that anytime I see, I know she's going to be around like beating people up. Like I have to watch the movie. Definitely shows in this film. People, make sure you check it out again, July 10th on Netflix. It's a ton of fun. Lots of great action, really cool characters, really awesome plot line in general. And I'm sure after you watch 10 minutes, you'll be hooked and want to finish the whole thing. Right now, let's get into Chiwetel's movies that changed his life. You picked three awesome films, all foreign films, which is the first time on the podcast. So let's go in chronological order. The first one is the classic Bicycle Thieves from 1948. This has an 8.3 out of 10 with 139,000 ratings on IMDb. Directed by Vittorio De Sica. Written by Cesare Zavattini. Based on the novel by Luigi Bartoloni. Starring Lamberto Maggiorani and Enzo Staiola. The story is a post-World War II Italian neo-realist drama that follows the story of a father and son looking for the father's stolen bicycle that he needs to provide income for his family. Chiwetel, so tell us a story here. When was the first time you watched this movie?
I suppose I watched it first when I was quite young. And I may be like on VHS maybe or something, or maybe it was even playing. It might have been just a late night special or an afternoon film on a Sunday or something. And then I didn't see it for a very long time. I mean, I liked the film, I think. I don't really remember it from that time. I just remember that when I saw it again, that I had seen parts of it before. And I saw it, years later on Wiltshire, actually, on Wiltshire Boulevard at the Lemley Theatre there. And they were just doing, they happened to be doing a screening of it. And I saw that they were doing a screening of Bicycle Thieves or The Bicycle Thief. It's either or, sort of interchangeable. Mm-hmm. And so I went along and I just had the most incredible moment, 2 hours of watching a film that I could remember, really. I just was completely, completely transported. And the fact that I was watching it projected and in a cinema watching this film, I think really added to the overall feeling. And so I did something that I have done since, but I do it so rarely. You know, I think everybody does it rarely, if people do it at all. But I went out after the film finished and bought another ticket and watched the film again. So I was like, so, and then a few days later, I took a friend of mine, because it was still playing for about a week, to come and see the film, who agreed that it was the best film. This is the best film, you know. So in a way, although I'd seen it when I was a kid, I hadn't really seen it until much later. And, you know, and then it just was so incredibly transporting that it has always been, you know, since that moment, one of the greatest films, you know, ever made.
Yeah. I had a similar, relationship with it, cause I had saw it when I was in high school, when I was sort of building my cinephile chops, and then I rewatched it, probably for the second time only, in prep for this interview. And it is so good. In terms of like Hollywood and film in 1940s, something I kind of thought of is like how Citizen Kane is like what film is about on the grand scheme and like the most like robust showmanship of filmmaking. Bicycle Thieves or Bicycle Thief is on the complete opposite spectrum. Like it is so rooted in reality. You know, something that's very famous about it is all shot on location in Rome, which at the time, especially for American films, it was not, you would never see that. It was all on sets. There are no name actors at the time for Bicycle Thieves. And it is so heartbreakingly realistic that you don't really see. I mean, even movies now that are very realistic and clearly influenced by this are not as like heart-wrenching and brutal. It's so fascinating. Is that something that sort of stood out to you, like when you watch it those several times, like the realism behind it?
Yeah, I mean, it's part of that, the sort of you know, the Italian neorealist tradition, you know, and De Sica kind of, in a way, single-handedly, I suppose, created that tradition. You know, the film comes in this kind of post World War II, very depressed Italy, totally kind of broke and people struggling to make ends meet, you know, and this family and this man trying to provide for his family in any way he can. And obviously it centers around him having a bicycle so he can put up posters of American movies, you know, and there's Rita Hayworth, he's putting up a poster. And then of course his bicycle is stolen and he has to track down who stole it. And the visual poetry that you sort of go through with this in just him traveling through Rome, and it's all, you know, and it all centers around the time when, you know, people are arriving in Rome for this football match that has been sort of laid into the conversation, and people are going to come in and watch it, and yet he's sort of going through from all sorts of different places, all these different corners of the city, trying to find the guy that stole his bicycle so he could hold his little corner, his tiny corner of the world together. And it becomes such a sort of rich and beautiful parable, you know, of the modern day of inequalities, of a person who has to struggle against society.
Yeah, there's the shot when the character, he first gets his job painting up the posters, and it's maybe for like 2 seconds where you first see him gluing up the poster, and he just has like the tiniest smirk of pride. And when you watch that, like, God, it's so good, because it, like you said, sort of like the economic situation of a post-World War II era, it really like captures like a side of Italy that you, especially as, you know, growing up an American, you don't see those sorts of stories told like that in World War II history. And you see just like the pride he's taking, putting it up. He's like, you know, I'm going to make $6,000 a week, I think he says, to be able to afford my family. You know, we're going to be able to go get fancy lunches and all sort of, and he's just thinking that. And then, you know, not too soon after that, he gets his bike stolen. And like this, like the emotion of that 2 seconds, it sounds so subtle and it's like not dramatic at all, but like you feel for him so well. And it's really like an incredible sequence there.
Heartbreaking.
Yeah. You've seen this movie, I guess, you know, obviously countless times or a handful of times. And does the ending ever sit with you any different after all these times?
No, the ending is phenomenal. I mean, it's because it's so many things, you know. It's, you know, the look on Bruno's face, his son, And that, and the actual tracking shot that's used on Bruno's face, you know, is it's just the classic quintessential moment of cinema, isn't it? It's like, it is, it is all that you want from cinema. It is all the rush of emotion. It is all of the empathy. It is all of the kind of drama that, and the uncertainty of what will happen next. What will the final moment be? You know, and you realize in that moment how invested you are in this family, in this guy and his son and this life that he's built. You know, you've gone so deep down the rabbit hole that, you know, you don't know whether you'll come out. And then, you know, and then it's the sort of the you know, the end of the film. And and so that's why, you know, as soon as I walked out of the cinema, I bought a ticket. I'm going to go back into that world somehow. I felt so connected.
It's a really beautiful film. Folks who listen, you haven't seen it, again, check it out. Bicycle Themes from 1948. Fantastic pick. I'm glad I got to revisit it because of this. All right, let's go to your second pick. This is 1982's Fanny and Alexander. It has an 8.1 out of 10 with 55,000 ratings, written and directed by the great Ingmar Bergman, starring Bertel Guva, Uwe Frohling, and Pernilla Alwyn. And the story is Fanny and Alexander. They're a siblings that takes place in 1900 Sweden, and it tells a story of their relationship with their mother, father, and eventual stepfather, the Bishop Edvard. So talk to me about this. When was the first time you saw this movie?
I mean, again, I saw this a long time ago and then revisited it not too long ago. And then saw the longer version. You know, there's also the sort of, you know, 5.5 hour version. So the 3 hour version, you know, this version is the kind of the cut, you know, the brief, the short, the Bergman short. But you know, it's one of those films that, it doesn't matter. It could go on for a lifetime. You know, you would be equally engaged, whatever length that the film was. It is so phenomenally done, phenomenally made. I mean, you know, the filmmaking quality of Bergman, obviously Bergman is one of the greatest filmmakers, full stop, has ever lived. And his films are all magnificent, and they're all sort of rich in different ways. You know, you might like one more than the other, but you're kind of, you know, it's not, they're all so extraordinarily realized, you know. And yet here is this film, and it's later on in his life and later on in his career, and for a while was thought of, it was going to be the last film, proper film, that he ever that he ever made and he ever embarked on. And it has so much energy. It's got so much kind of youthful, ambitious kind of quality to it that you could, if you were squinting, you would think that this was somebody's incredibly well-made first, second, third film, you know. But yet, because it's got all of that kind of passion for filmmaking, you know, it's not, it's just not, there's nothing that is sort of rested about it. It's just ambitious and energetic and, you know, really focused and in total love with these characters and this world. And the highs are really high, this amazing Swedish family that are so kind of exuberant, and they're all, you know, they're actors.
The best Christmas party of all time.
Exactly. This insane Christmas party, and they're all actors and artists, and, you know, and they live these big lives, and they're, you know, and they're in love, and they're happy, and they're also, you know, in their own way, manipulative, and, you know, and there's, you know, there's, and there's sort of internal dramas and politics, and then there's the patriarch passes away, and, you know, and life changes for, you know, for Fanny and Alexander, and so the lows become these depths that they go to, and these painful places that they explore. So it's real drama, and it really has an enthusiasm for drama. You know, and I love it. I love its time as well. I love that sort of post, you know, just in the early part of the 20th century, and the kind of idea of that, you know, early 1900s, before a layer of craziness, you know, unseen, descended on Europe, where there was real, that kind of really capturing and going back and capturing that real sense of optimism, that real sense of that progress is possible, that life is possible, that all these kind of loves are possible, and you know, and the good will win out at the end of the day, you know. And it's just, it sort of does for me just capture a moment in time before, before, you know, obviously the events of 1914 and then later the events of the late 30s, you know, and just the collapse of everything essentially. But yeah, I think it does that just incredibly well, you know.
Yeah, it's also such a love letter to the theater. I think the first shot even it has like features marionettes and someone like kind of peering through. There's so many shots throughout the film that Bergman obviously chose very specifically where things are looking through frames or things are looking through windows, sort of like staging everything as a play. And I thought that's interesting because this, like you said, this was intended to be his last film he shot, proper film he shot. And it's also autobiographical in some ways. So to me, it felt like it was like kind of, you know, all the shots of the theater setting and the framing made it seem like he was trying to peer back into his own life, which I thought was kind of like an interesting concept there. Are you a fan of Bergman otherwise? Like, you know, do you go back and see all, have you seen all his other films?
Yeah,
and stuff like that?
Yeah. I mean, I love Bergman's films, you know, and I mean, they're so, you know, Wild Strawberries, of course, you know, the idea, I think, because, you know, Through a Glass Darkly, was my introduction to Bergman, because I think that was the first Bergman film I saw, which is kind of a crazy place to start. But it was, I just was, you know, I just thought that if you can create a film, you know, with four people on an island, so very limited sets, and you can take an audience to that depth of understanding of this family, of what is happening to them. And it's so, some of it is so challenging and so dark, you know, that it is, that you feel sort of wrung through by the end of it. But it's just that he has created in this tiny little bubble, you know, this amazing reality. And of course, he does a very similar thing with even less people in Persona, which is... Persona is an extraordinary film that you can kind of watch 100 times and find different things in. And,
yeah,
you know, and this relationship with these two women who are, and they're the only characters in the film for maybe 90%, maybe 95% of the film is, you know, and the performances that he gets, you know, are, you know, and then, you know, I love Scenes from a Marriage as well, which is again, another one of his very sort of long films, but I find Scenes of a Marriage so, I find it like so funny, you know, I find their marriage and their dynamic so amusing as well. And that he can layer in, you know, all of this kind of humor that he finds. And I think that he, I think there are a number of Bergman films where he finds that kind of, that sort of sly humor. I think even in The Seventh Seal, you know, when the knight is traveling along the road and his squire sees a man sitting down by a hill, and he taps the man on the shoulder, and the man is actually dead, and so it's just a skull that sort of flips up and looks at him, and so he goes back to the knight, and the knight says something like, you know, did the guy say anything? And the squire says, oh yeah, he said quite a lot. It's just he spoke very eloquently about our circumstances. And there's always in Bergman these kind of sort of sly humor, but then he can take it to this incredibly bleak place as well, like Cries and Whispers, and where you are for the first time, you know, Cries and Whispers for me is when you are really confronted with an artist really grappling with death in a really profound way, and in a terrifying way. And this, and these sisters together, again, very small cast, waiting and watching their sister, you know, who's struggling and dying, you know, and it's so painful, but never, you know, just not that, you don't want to turn away. You're just sort of so captured and engaged. So, yeah, I think that, you know, I mean, as everybody knows, you know, he's one of the, if not the greatest filmmaker, you know, it's the experience of watching his films is transportive.
Experience is the best way to experience, like to describe watching a Bergman. I mean, everything is so immersive, and in the case of Fan and Alexander, incredibly long, right? I mean, it's 3 hours, it's the director's cut. there's almost an almost 6 hour version as well that got released for it. You know, and the way Fanny Alexander, my last note on this is that it feels like it's not a Bergman, and then it is, if that makes sense to you. Like, the first half of the movie, maybe the first, you know, quarter of the movie, feels very different than his other films for those who are, like, familiar with it. And then it becomes obviously, like, a Bergman, where he, like, sort of twists it and puts in this, like, psychological thing and like that. It's so interesting. So do you get the same feeling of that from watching this movie?
Totally, totally. And that's really what I mean, that you feel like you're going to watch this Bergman film and that it's, you know, later in his life. So you think that you're going to go, you know, he's going to out Bergman, you know, you right. think you're going to really go down the, you know. And actually what starts off is something very, very, very different. It just starts off with this kind of lightness of touch, all of this sort of fun, all of this exuberance. And that's kind of what I mean about it feeling like, you know, as somebody's very early, very ambitious, mm-hmm. you know, but, and obviously very brilliant, but, you know, this kind of somebody's early film. But it then, and then only as you realize the depth, because obviously, one of the great things about Bergman is the way that he works with script. You know, mm-hmm. the depth of the scripts and the depths of these characters and the interactions, and you start to feel like, oh, actually, this is really turning a corner, and is becoming. It has all of the richness of a Bergman film, but it also has this playful humor again that is even more stepped up now. The mm-hmm. circumstances that they find themselves in have this sly, subtle, you know, wit to them. And, you know, and I think, you know, I just think it's, yeah, I think it's exactly right. I think it's a wonderful example of him just changing a little bit of direction and being very surprising with it as well.
1982's Fanny and Alexander. Again, if you're not familiar with Bergman, go and watch all of his movies. I think you'll find that in all of his movies, he has influenced many modern filmmakers today. And Fan Alexander, if you want to brave the 6 hour version, please do it. Please do it. But there is also a 3 hour director's cut as well. I also recommend watching it in the Swedish language. I know there are a couple dub versions out there, but definitely watch it in Swedish with the subtitles. You know, you kind of get the beauty of the language like that. Before we get to your last pick, I want to give some love to your hometown, London, England, because London, England is one of my favorite cities in the world. I mean, I've been all over, and every time I'm over there, I like immediately want to live there. How do you think that influenced you into becoming like an actor and loving film? I know you did a lot of stage plays and a lot of Shakespeare stuff, but how about like the city itself? Do you think there's like an energy about the city that made you want to be in theater or film?
Well, yes. I mean, you know, I when I was the high school that I went to was it was called Dulwich College, and and it's a very nice school, but it was, and it was main, or one of its main distinctions is it was founded by Edward Alleyne, who was a director of Shakespeare's plays and Shakespeare's contemporary, you know, in the times. He directed the first sort of Shakespeare plays, and that whole area of Dulwich was, you know, it's named after actors, the street names is what I mean, is named after actors, John Burbage on Burbage Road and so on. And growing up, I was surrounded by, you know, these ideas. When I went to the Edward Alleyne Hall to do my first Shakespearean plays, you know, this very rich sort of history in this neighborhood. And a lot of people from there and thereabouts, you know, there was other schools. There was a sort of sister school, James Allen's Girls' School, and Alleyne's, which was the mixed school, co-ed school. And so, you know, there were people who had gone on to become actors who were out of these schools. And so there was this really rich tradition from these three schools in this neighborhood that had and the neighborhood in itself had a rich tradition of acting. So, so in a very real sense, you know, being in London, being at school, you know, was my first kind of real introduction to the theater. Simply. And as soon as I started doing plays, I was just really excited about exploring, you know, this manner of self-expression, which is kind of how I thought of it then and do still think of it that way. You know, I found it a remarkable way to explore self, to think of yourself channeled through other people and all of these other experiences and all these other places, and this real celebration of humanity. So, you know, so it was after that process that I then started to make films. And in my early 20s, I started making films in the UK a lot more. And you know, I made a film called Dirty Pretty Things when I was about 24. And that was a film that was very London centric, but also everybody in the film, you know, just these practitioners of cinema in the UK, you know, Stephen Frears and, you know, Chris Menges, the cinematographer, you know, people who are sort of part of a very kind of long tradition of cinema in the UK. So I just felt like I was plugged into something there. And I felt, and I, you know, I also fell in love at that point with the poetry of cinema. So that was really a kind of starting point for me around then. And it was definitely very connected with the UK and the traditions of cinema here.
Let's go to your last film here. I'm very excited to talk about this. This is Sans Soleil from 1983. 8.0 out of 10 with only 9,000 ratings on IMDb. It is written and directed by Chris Marker. There's no real cast in the film, but it is narrated by Florence DeLay or Alexandra Stewart, depending on which version you watch with the narration. And the synopsis, I guess, is, as I kind of want to put it, is a woman narrates a contemplative writings of a seasoned world traveler known as Sandra Krasna. And it is an examination of identity and time, largely between, you know, Japan and countries in Africa. That's kind of a hard way to describe it. It's hard to describe this movie at all. Truth also, what was the first time you saw this movie? What was your experience with it?
I saw this film pretty recently, actually.
Oh, okay.
I hadn't, you know, I'd known of Chris Marker because of La Jetée, and so, you know, his sort of 40-minute sci-fi film, and that's excellent. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And some of his documentaries about the 60s revolution, Grin Without a Cat, and but I hadn't seen Sans Soleil, and then it was recommended to me, and I watched it, and you know, it changed my life. It changed my perspective of what certain kinds of imaging can do in storytelling, and it just opened up my eyes to this, you know, to something which is a combination of things. This film, it's a documentary, it's a travelogue, and it's a kind of poetic essay, you know, that is that combined has a kind of meditative quality, but it talks about something really profound and powerful in the sort of overall idea of the kind of human journey and where time and memory meet and create our kind of perception of self and our perception of individualism and also, you know, and broader, you know, society, culture, all of these things, you know. He travels through Japan. He's in Guinea-Bissau. He's in the States. You know, and in each of these places, he's able to find this kind of, you know. He starts actually the film in Iceland and ends the film there. You know, and in each of these places, he's able to find the kind of connective tissue through all of these different realities. Through the voice that is his voice, but it's his, you know, his sort of pseudonym's voice, as he, you know, and a woman is narrating a letter that she receives from him, and it's profound. And the way that the images work together with the kind of editorial choices of these kind of these graphic matches, so that not only are the matches part of the narrative experience, you know, that you can connect places to each other or incidents to each other, but it's also part of the kind of spiritual experience of watching the film, of understanding places connected and themes connected across us all and a certain kind of universality. And then the ideas of a sort of technology that is also behind everything, that is reaching in. I mean, and in that way, ahead of its time, you know, that this technology is surrounding everybody and is waiting to kind of pounce and capture all of this, everything, you know, that he sees these, you know, at one point he goes to this this store where they're doing these sort of graphic computer games and these imagings on these computer games. And he takes images that he took of emus at another point, and he puts them into this kind of graphic imaging machine, you know, and the last few lines are like, one day there will be emus in the zone, because he calls that image sort of network the zone. And I felt like it's ahead of its time. It's sort of understanding the weight of technology that people kind of are in now, how isolating that is, how sometimes dispassionate it is, how removed it is from the human experience, and somehow going back to human beings and their memories and their understandings of their lives is such a kind of powerful way to tell a story.
It's incredibly intimate. I mean, I think there are maybe no wide shots, at the very least, very few wide shots throughout the whole thing. Almost every shot of the documentary feels like a travel diary. Like most shots are from the chest up of people, sort of really tight zoom ins, walking through crowds and all sort of stuff. And speaking of like relationships and humanity, my favorite sequence was he's watching a street festival and he takes note of a woman across the street. And he has this really beautiful piece of dialogue where he says, you know, I saw her, she saw me, she glanced at me for a second, you know, just for one frame. And it kind of talks about this like playfulness he had with this woman he had never met, about how she knows he has a camera, he knows she knows. And like, there's this really beautiful play of these people who never speak, they never talk, and their interactions got to be 5 seconds, like in real time tops. And it's like profound in a way that I can't really explain. Because I think everyone has had a situation where they've noticed a camera on them, whether it's someone taking a photo at like, you know, a theme park or at a tourist spot or something like that, or someone just kind of being a street photographer. And there's a weird, like very personal moment you have with someone that's hard to explain. And it is captured and explained perfectly here. And this is well ahead of time, like you said, ahead of time of social media where cameras are everywhere. And there's still like this like very real thing that's, you know, from 1983 that's very relevant today. So that was my favorite sequence from the film. Do you have other favorite moments, or
I love all of the sequences in Guinea-Bissau, actually. That whole kind of way that he's taking footage from Guinea-Bissau and the revolution there, the successful revolution that kicked out the Portuguese in Guinea-Bissau. And he is explaining this was actually one of the revolutions that inspired revolution in the Western world. But then all of this is completely forgotten by history. All of it is completely sort of, the pages are just completely turned. I think they describe it as like history throws its empty bottles out the window, you know, which is such a great way of even explaining that. And he has this time in Guinea-Bissau then, and then he cuts forward to the leadership several years later, and he match cuts, you know, the leadership then and now, some of them the exact same images of people waving against the shoreline, or the leader waving against the shoreline, who then also himself gets undercut. You know, I just think that whole idea of pulling in all of these historical victories, all of these ideas that, and how, you know, that the tragic nature of us is that we tend to forget, you know, we constantly rewrite history and we omit so much, you know, and some of the things that we omit are useful, they're valuable, they could help us now. And he's talking about that, you know, he's talking about arriving back on the Japanese islands and tracing the path that the American GIs went through when they were in the war, and how there's tiny communities who experience and know of a world before that, you know, that is a recent memory to them. What they talk about and how they communicate, even though this particular group is kind of dying out, is holding on to the distant history of their communities and cultures, you know, the things that really inform and tell them the truth of who they are. And I just think that I think there's so much in the film that is about that, how we compartmentalize and cherry pick history and not really even the important parts, you know, not even the real information. And it felt very beautiful that he was able to kind of to sort of recognize that and put that into a story in a way that feels so poetic and honest without ever seeming loaded or didactic. It's easy and it's profound. You know, I mean, I immediately when I saw the film printed out the entire all of the stories.
Yeah, so yeah, it's like a book almost. It. Yeah,
you know, just sort of read it for myself, you know, as well, and then you can look at the images on their own, you know, as well. It's just such a kind of beautifully comprised, you know, put together story, a way of telling stories. It just doesn't, you know, it just hits you on an emotional level, you know. It really captures that and how to do that, I think.
Yeah, it's really like unlike anything I've seen. I mean, documentary is kind of an interesting way to put it because it's really so much, I feel like a film essay is almost a better way to put it because the narration is so core. It's very dense, very eloquent and intelligent, and it matches up with this, the really like beautiful cinematography and something like it's very like visceral and like graphics kind of blasting your face. It's really unlike anything. I had never seen it prior to this. So thank you for introducing this one to me.
That's great.
And like, highly recommended to anyone, Sans Soleil from 1983. So last question here to Attell. Do you see any through lines between Bicycle Thieves, Fanny and Alexander and Sans Soleil?
I suppose the through lines are where they hit me emotionally, I think, you know, that I feel that these are stories that are so connected and so humanistic, you know, that they're just connected to the human experience so profoundly. And I think that for me, I think, is what is so rich about any art form, that once you just connect onto the journey, you know, of what I think what art is trying to do, you know, that it creates a kind of, that art at its best creates a sort of family of man, you know, and that I think is you know, that these are all films from very different places in the world at different times exploring very different things. But I think anybody watching these three films can relate to all of these experiences and understand all of these experiences very profoundly. And then to watch them captured in the way that they are, in the artistic and poetic style that they have been made, and give the kind of human emotion its kind of epic due, its epic kind of value and epic worth, I think is always so staggering to me. And I feel that it's, these are only created by directors of incredible understanding and empathy and, you know, great heart and intellect. You know, so in that sense, I feel that they're connected on that journey.
Beautiful and perfect. Thank you so much. These are three fantastic movies. Again, Bicycle Thieves, Fan Alexander, and Sans Soleil. And don't forget, folks, Chiwetel is going to be in The Old Guard, which is going to be on Netflix July 10th. It's a fantastic movie. Really, really fun action sequences. Really great characters. And I'm hoping we see more of it. Any last things, Chiwetel?
No, that's perfect. That's just exactly right. Yeah, thank you.
Perfect. All right. Well, thank you so much. Talk to you soon.
Speak soon. Thanks. Bye now.
Thanks so much for listening. Be sure to head over to imdb.com/podcasts for more content on Chiwetel and to easily add the movies that changed his life to your IMDb watch list.